spending money and growing, not at a sustainable pace, but at this like hyper accelerated pace to rapidly take up market share and drown out other competitors. And when you keep raising money to do that, you keep giving more and more people that are not you big chunks of your business. And so the only way it works is if you have a little bit of luck, but also, of course, great execution, the ability to fundraise and a great product, and you actually become that unicorn, because then the pie is big enough for everybody.
Ushma Garg is the founder and CEO of Gobble, a meal kit company that has revolutionized home cooking with its 15-minute one-pan meal kits. After experiencing the challenges of maintaining a healthy diet while running her first startup in college, Ushma realized the importance of quick and easy home-cooked meals for busy people. Her ability to identify and address consumer needs, coupled with a deep understanding of market fit, has led Gobble to immense success, culminating in a strategic acquisition where she continues to guide and expand the company's vision. Get ready to hear Ushma's story and her biggest business secrets. Coming up, you'll hear about her college days at Stanford and how it shaped her entrepreneurial path, her learning lessons from Ushma's early startup days and how she's applied them to develop and scale Gobble. Ushma shares her journey to finding Gobble's product market fit. She talks about navigating the M&A process through strategic planning. And finally, she reveals her biggest business secrets. This is the Entrepreneurista podcast, presented by Socialfly.
It's the best business meeting you'll ever have, with must-hear real-life looks at how leading women in business are getting it done
and what it takes to build and grow a successful company.
It's beyond the gram,
with no filters,
no limits,
and plenty of surprises. Ushma, I am so thrilled to sit down with you today and hear all about your entrepreneurista journey. But I have to ask you, when you were growing up as a child, did you always know that ultimately you wanted to start your own business when you got older?
I don't think I knew that I would start a business, but I was always starting something, like whether it was a Beanie Baby trading marketplace or the classic lemonade stand or, you know, and then I started, you know, starting student organizations and fundraisers and things like this. So I was always innovating on the side.
You just saw my face when you just said Beanie Babies, because you're the first person who's talked about Beanie Babies besides myself, because I had a Beanie Baby resale business in middle school.
Yes.
And no one's ever talked about Beanie Babies besides me talking about this Beanie Baby resale business. Wait, that's amazing.
Yes, yes, absolutely. We'd have friends come over and, like, you know, barter and everything. And yeah.
I still remember all the names of, you know, all of the Peace Bear. And I remember selling things for like $35 and marking things up and putting up signs. So, oh my gosh, I love that. So we both had it in us from the time we were little. So walk me through your career journey and what ultimately led you to start your business.
Well, I came out to Silicon Valley for school. I went to Stanford for undergrad. And I think that's what, you know, really exposed me to kind of taking this like entrepreneurial spirit into a career, or made it really normal that people were, you know, not just like throwing an event or a fundraiser, but they were like going out on their own for their careers. And freshman year, there was a career fair for a summer job, and I was going to, you know, go abroad or volunteer. But a woman stopped me and kind of pitched me on her 7-person startup. And I handed her my resume, not thinking much of it. And then I ended up interning at a startup called SayNow, which was later acquired by Google, for that summer. And I think that first experience really changed my life.
That's so amazing to have had that experience so early on in your career while you were in school. What were some of the things that you saw during that time, during your first job there, that really helped like set the stage for you in terms of what you've went on to build?
Well, like so many things. First of all, that I love in the startup culture that people don't, you know, there's no like strict hierarchy or, you know, rank order based on age or experience. Folks looked at me and thought that I could contribute something really meaningful to their company, even though I was just, you know, a young college student. So I really liked that belief and hope in people, no matter what their experience or what they look like, et cetera. I also, I was in charge of taking a a mobile product to market and going out there and sitting with people at Starbucks and testing this product and figuring out use cases. So what was really interesting was seeing that the original hypotheses that the startup founders had wasn't really how their product was going to be used. And putting something into the wild and watching how, you know, how normal people, what do they do with it? And coming back with a number of use cases, kind of getting to the whiteboard and then figuring out which direction to kind of double down on. So it was just neat to have all, it was very empowering to have that opportunity. And then also to look at a startup as kind of a, like as an experimental process and as, and to allow the results to reveal themselves as opposed to thinking that like an individual knows everything.
Up next, you'll hear how a personal challenge led Ushma to create the innovative meal kit service, Gobble. So tell me where the idea for Gobble came to be.
So after that first startup experience, I started my own company in my dorm room as a junior at Stanford. I didn't drop out, but I guess I stopped out or dropped out for one semester and like hired other students as interns and like lifted the bed to the ceiling and stuffed desks in my room. And it was pretty neat. But I ran that company for 3 years, bootstrapped. And during that time, I gave it everything. And I like kind of put my health aside, my eating habits aside. And that's really where Gobble came in. My health had reached kind of a breaking point because of my obsession and commitment and ambition with my first company. And I was kind of just like finding myself eating one meal a day, which was at 2 a.m. at a rotation of like Jack in the Box, In-N-Out, or McDonald's on El Camino Real in Silicon Valley. So I guess my dad noticed that I wasn't eating well, and he cooked home cooked food for us my entire life growing up. So he cooked some of his food, which is kind of this like colorful and vegetarian Indian food. He flew from Texas to California with his like, you know, suitcases of home cooking. And he like sat me down and kind of fed me back to health. And I think that trip of his or that moment is what really inspired the mission behind Gobble, which was that food is not just nourishment, but food is family, it's connection, it's belonging, and it's love. And for me, I needed that in my life. So in this 24/7 busy world, how can we help more people put home-cooked food on the table? So I just fell in love with that mission and the importance of that in my life and decided to start kind of iterating on the side and seeing if others felt the same.
Talk to me about that process. You still have this other business you're running. Now you have this idea to start Gobble on the side to see if there's any traction there. What ended up happening with that company and how did you end up transitioning to focus on Gobble full time?
So that business was making quite a bit of money. It was a LinkedIn for students, a professional network for students in undergrad and graduate schools. And a lot of law schools joined my professional network. And I was getting paid by law firms to recruit from it. So with a yearly subscription of like $10,000 to $50,000. So that was pretty great for kind of, you know, just a junior in college to be receiving these checks
on
the website. Yeah. You know, at the time, the legal world and law schools especially weren't so much on social media and technology. And so there was a legal recruiting business called LawWorks that ended up acquiring my professional network. And I was, the timing was all great. I had known some of these players, but I was also kind of burnt out inside. The way my first business had evolved didn't align with kind of like my heart and soul and what I wanted to do with my life. So I was very open and ready to kind of do something else. So I was lucky enough to be able to like land that plane and sell that business. And months prior, I had just started Gobble as not as a business, but as a solution to my own problem. I posted an ad on Craigslist, asked if anybody would make me dinner for $8 a plate, said that, you know, I'll get whatever, like 10 friends together. So we'll pay you $80. And in 24 hours, I got 70 responses from chefs all over the Bay Area who wanted to share their home cooking. So like I thought that the demand was there. The supply was definitely there. And inadvertently, I had discovered this kind of peer-to-peer lasagna home-cooked meal marketplace.
That is amazing. I want to go back just for one moment to touch on your prior startup and just some of those learning lessons. So when you share how you were completely, you know, burnt out, you're working around the clock, you weren't taking care of yourself and eating well, and just the way you were running that business, what were some of those learning lessons that you then brought to Gobble that you didn't want to repeat again?
Well, a couple lessons. One is that I think that thinking big is a skill and it's a muscle that we develop over time. So I thought that that idea for this professional network for students was just the biggest idea at the time, like that it was going to be huge and Facebook had just started and things like this. So I thought it was really great. Right or wrong, the feedback I got was that the model that I was pursuing was not, you know, this huge multi-billion dollar advertising business. It was a recruiting model and it wasn't seen as venture scale at the time. Mm-hmm. So I think those lessons and that feedback from investors at the time kind of taught me how to ideate, how to think big, and like what defines big. So with Gobble, I ended up thinking much bigger and nationally and to like millions of consumers and so on. Another lesson is that the business evolves around whoever pays you. So I was building my first business for students, but the people paying me were these recruiting departments at law and consulting firms. They wanted different things. They wanted to fill certain quotas for recruiting and so on, and kind of not help people find their dream job or find mentors or things that I was interested in. So that taught me that in my future business, the way that I make money has to align with my mission. And that's what happened mm-hmm. with Gobble.
I love that. And I'm so glad you shared those lessons. So let's fast forward now. You start building Gobble. Tell me a bit about the journey, because you started Gobble, was it 2010?
Yes.
Take me back to 2010.
Alrighty.
If you can remember that far back, I'm like from 2020 to 2024, it's all a blur. So if you can remember back to 2010, tell me about those early days.
Yes. Well, we started without a website. I had like a calendar piece of paper and I asked those chefs to come bring me and a friend a plate of food. So first we were eating for free for a month or so, just interviewing chefs for our like made up business. And then after that, I think one out of five or seven actually kind of we loved and worked out, were, you know, somewhat professional enough to do this. So I made a calendar of like a meal plan calendar. And I ended up contacting startups in the area, people in my like college network and stuff, to see if they wanted to like place orders for their late night working teams. And so pretty soon, like in the first month, we made like $2,000 profit. In the second month, $4,000 and so on. Because first people were just willing to give it a shot as a friend. And then if we had chosen good chefs and the food was good enough, then they kind of made it a weekly subscription order. So it was really neat. The beginning was very smooth. And with only like 3 or 4 months of traction, we had mocked up what a website might look like for the broader public. Peer-to-peer companies were taking off at the time for like, you know, sharing assets, Etsy, Airbnb, that kind of stuff. And so we were almost inadvertently like entering this like hot phase of Silicon Valley. And we were able to raise like $1.5 million from some of the greats here just within months of proving the concept.
That's pretty amazing that you were able to build that so quickly and have a good beta test right away and raise over $1 million within the first couple of months. What were some of those learning lessons from raising capital? Was that your first time raising capital?
Yes, it was. It was my first time raising capital or any kind of like venture or angel funding. One of the lessons of just that phase was that to have an MVP or a minimum viable product, but to clarify even more, that product doesn't have to be a web or software product. You just have to prove the concept. So with my first business, I wanted to build a website, this professional network right away. And my mentor from that first startup I worked at told me, well, why don't you just start with an email list? Let's just get students on an email list and see if they are interested in your content, the jobs you're bringing, the mentors you're bringing, et cetera. And then we can invest all the time and money to make a website. And I was offended at that time by this suggestion. I was like, no, this is really big. I need to make a website. The email list just seems, you know, very basic and not lucrative. But that lesson got learned. And so with Gobble, there was no shame in just like proving out the logistics, the revenue, the supply, the demand, the product, or the food product, I guess, before turning it into sort of a scalable e-commerce or subscription website. So we raised money without that, like without any tech built. And I think that that's, you know, critical for folks listening, because sometimes they invest a lot of money and effort into the tech, but not into the proof of concept.
Yes, such a great point. So walk me through what happens next. You raise this first round of capital. Is the business today the model that it was when you first launched and raised that first round, or is it different?
It's quite different. You know, we were an early startup in the food space. So we started with the home delivery of meals made by local chefs. And then on-demand food came up. So there were these companies that were, you could order it and they promised it would be there within like 10 to 30 minutes. And they were kind of vans driving around with food in their car. So we ended up doing pilot tests in all of these different models of the, just like the food startup wars. We were iterating for about 3 years until we kind of found the idea that like struck gold or product market fit. The first ideas would get to $1 million a year in annual revenues. So this home cooking marketplace, an on-demand model. We even did like corporate lunch subscriptions, things like this. Then we got our own kitchen because relying on all the home chefs and their kitchens, there was a bit too much uncertainty. And we, you know, we were scaling and looking at food safety and all of this. And we started innovating in the not just the technology and the business model, but also in the food. And so instead of giving someone a fully made meal, we gave them this like 15-minute, you know, one pan meal kit. And the idea was that we'll do all the prep for you and we'll be your sous chef and we'll like slave away and make a sauce for 4 days and you'll just finish it off and look like the hero in your house, which everybody loves. And I think folks may not know, but so many companies leverage this like easy bake hero idea. Like Instagram has made everybody a photographer. IKEA makes it easy for you to make furniture. Like every company's trying to help you hack your way to some sort of expertise. So that idea like went from 0 to 6 million in its first year without so much of a push. It was just that lightning in a bottle product market fit year for us. So that's how I knew that we had really struck, you know, a new way of doing something that had that 10x difference from ordering takeout or cooking, you know, from scratch. And that's kind of what we ended up scaling further, taking nationally, raising a Series B for, et cetera.
I have to say, and Courtney's not recording with us today, but she just tried Gobble for the first time. And she did say it only took a few minutes to make the meals. It was simple and easy. And she absolutely love the food. So I'm excited. I have to be the next one to try Gobble as well, because I'm not a great cook. But if stuff is prepared for me and I can do it quickly, it's good news.
Awesome. Yes.
So I would love to hear, Ushma, so now you find this product market fit with the 15-minute meals, but you had been testing these other business models as well. Were you like slowly phasing those out while you were testing the new 15-minute meals? Were you running everything simultaneously? How were you managing it all? Talk me through how you made all that happen.
Yeah, we always had, like at that time, one model running and live for everybody and kind of one secret model in the background until we thought that we found the one. So we were, for example, delivering food in kind of like just compostable takeout containers that was made by chefs and portioned. We were delivering that all over the Bay Area, but behind the scenes, we were inventing these kits and saying, okay, you know, how much should we actually cook of it or not? Should it have 8 ingredients or 6? And we would kind of make them in the background. I would email some of the top users. I would say, hey, would you like to, you know, check out this new product, new program. It's free. And all we need you to do is fill out this like survey that we'll pick up. I remember that being so fun. They were so excited to be part of innovation with us. And the results were, you know, showed us that it was such a groundbreaking product for us and so different than what they were eating on the other days. So that was really exciting.
Once you found this product market fit and the model that worked, can you talk to me about your marketing strategy and how you scaled to $6 million in revenue in the first year?
Yes. Funny enough, I know it can sound like a lot, but that $6 million of revenue in the first year was, you know, I feel like I can't even take a lot of credit for it. And it's because when the product is so good, it markets itself. And some people talk about how like excessive marketing is there to sort of cover up or make up for the fact that a product might just be a commodity, but we have to kind of add that razzle dazzle to it. So at that time, the product just sold itself and people told their friends. We had a an email list built up from a few years of iterating. So we let everybody know about the new product, and it was just so good that those people came back to try it and they kept using it. And so we were leveraging a base that we had, but that just wasn't active or interested in whatever we were doing before we did these 15-minute meal kits. So that was really neat. It's kind of how, like, if you put in years and years of work and years of like meeting all these people, then it can all come together and rise. Really, it seems like it's overnight, but it's really the summation of like years of trials of product and also years of building a following and people who've tried you at least once. But after that, we did have to differentiate and like invest in marketing and scale. And that's a different story.
What were some of the places that you invested in marketing once you're ready to do that?
I don't think there was like any magic trick to the marketing. It was really just rolling up our sleeves, raising the money and getting the budget and setting up this, you know, broad and dedicated and experimental marketing strategy. Nowadays, I think at the time, when early on in Facebook advertising and so on, people prioritize differently the channel and the content and like the design of the ad and things like this. For example, in direct mail, some folks would say that the targeting is more important than the content. However, I think nowadays on, you know, Instagram or TikTok and things like this, like content is king and paramount. So I think from where I was, I think marketing has changed dramatically. And I don't know if companies are innovating or changing their spend fast enough. I think they're still kind of pushing money down these channels when really some of the money can be saved if the creative department and the content is more invested in.
Yes, that's such a great tip. And I see that now too, especially with creating content that I say is like quite literally has to be thumb stopping because there's just so much content that you consume every single day across email, social platforms, wherever you look, there's marketing. So how can you actually create this content that people are really going to stop and pay attention to and then actually take an action? And I find now, and tell me if you're saying this too, I feel like people used to see things like once or twice and then like take that final action to buy. But now because there's so much noise out there, you have to like be showing up everywhere multiple times, you know, 5 to 8 times before people finally take that action to purchase.
I mean, I like that things change. It keeps, you know, competition and companies and life very fresh. But I think the change in marketing kind of parallels this generational like shift that's happening. It was, you know, Gen X, millennials, and Gen Z. And there's all these like jokes and memes about how sort of the older generations were a bit more kind of prim and proper about their work culture. And kind of the Gen Z or Gen Alpha and so on are a bit more like authentic or themselves or quirky or loose about it. And I think the brands that are a bit older brands have sort of this like stuffy brandness to them. And sort of the younger brands show a little bit more like pizzazz or make fun of themselves or aren't afraid of being so casual. And I think that's kind of the shift that needs to happen for at least for incumbents to stay on top. But it creates a really big opportunity for new companies starting.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. Can you talk to me a bit about direct mail and direct mail marketing strategies? Has that been a really big driver for you?
Yes and no. It ebbed and flowed over the years. I think the channel got saturated at a certain point. Our journey was quite long, over 10 years. And it got more and more expensive with more D2C companies and brands popping up and investing in the channel. So it's always been part of our marketing strategy, but it's by no means the majority strategy for us. But I think it's a very critical component. Everybody still has to check their mail. And it's another sort of like you said, that thumb-stopping moment. But if you give them something tactile, it's possible they will stop or hold on to that coupon. Which, you mentioning that brings me to a really interesting idea. I think that direct mail is actually pretty stuffy and old and stodgy and in its designs and in the letters and things like that you get. I wonder if something new and fresh could be applied there.
Yeah, let's come up with all the ideas now and launch a new campaign, right? No, I completely agree. I feel like, first of all, I love getting the mail because I have a 4.5-year-old. So she loves like if I come in and bring something and there's something for her. So like we always make getting the mail like a big thing. But anytime there's a coupon or like learning about a new company, you can, like you said, can actually touch and feel it. You can make a really big first impression or second or third impression to then finally take that action. Did you always do like your direct mail in-house? Did you work with any third-party companies to help execute direct mail strategies?
We definitely worked with some third-party companies. I think we, you know, shifted around between two or three over time.
And did you find like doing any partnerships with other companies that also had boxes that were being delivered, like co-marketing partnership? Did you do any of those type of strategies as well that you found worked?
We did. We have done and do everything. And I can't say that there was, in that case, I think we, you know, we would get signups and the partnership would have like some numbers. I don't recall any specific one being a smashing success. I think it's hard to stand out in any of these places. And so, and most people just say, well, why don't we do a card swap? I'll put something in your, you know, baby box and you put it in my food box. But consumers are so used to now getting a few promotional things that I think it's all just noise to them. And so in order for something to actually really, really stand out, I think there has to be quite a bit of heart and planning and preparation in those partnerships. And maybe even more of a 360 strategy, like combined with an interview or concerted and cohesive, like email and text and something more authentic. I think that the users are smart and it's unspoken, but they can probably tell like this is just something thrown in a box. It's just advertising.
Yeah, such great advice. Okay, so for everyone who is listening to come up with new strategies in your business, really making these partnerships cohesive and stand out. So it's not just another piece of paper in the mail, especially when it's direct mail co-marketing partnership. Ushma, I would love to hear more about the rest of your fundraising journey and how did you know when it was time to raise more capital?
I think the ideal time is once you have a few months of traction on something great and you can demonstrate that and in a convincing way that you'll use money as that rocket fuel to scale. The not ideal time is when you're already running out of money and your back's against the wall because folks can tell that you have some fear or you're desperate. So if you're building a venture scale or venture backed business, which is a huge if, I think folks should think very carefully about taking venture capital money before they take that first dollar. It's not just money. It comes with a whole structuring of your business. All the bylaws are rewritten, the documents are redone, you have a board, and you all of a sudden are implicitly promising these venture capitalists that, you know, that you're going to try to be a $1 billion business or you're okay with like going for the gold or bust. And that's not always, A, not every business is built to be that large, and B, that's not always in the founder's interest. So it's sexy and great, and we're in this like snow globe of venture capital as the, you know, as one big like medal that you get. But it's important for people to take a step back because you only get one life. And you need to think about if that's the contract in the world you want to sign up for. It's a bit of a one-way door. Like the venture capitalists that I meet, they say that like their role on boards lasts longer than most of their marriages. So like you are going to be stuck with that person and with that promise to that firm for a long time. It's really hard to unwind. So first of all, that's something to be really thoughtful about. Because then if you want to do that, you're expected to try to go for that hyperscale. And that means like spending money and growing at a non-natural rate, really, not at a sustainable pace, but at this like hyper-accelerated pace to rapidly take up market share and like drown out other competitors and to keep raising money to do that. And when you keep raising money to do that, you keep giving more and more people that are not you big chunks of your business. And so the only way it works is if you have a little bit of luck, but also of course, like great execution, the ability to fundraise and a great product, and you actually become that unicorn because then the pie is big enough for everybody. You know, the stories aren't told of all the, you know, 999 out of 1,000 that don't succeed. And there are people who are building smaller businesses and things that are much more successful than them in the venture world.
Yes, I'm glad you shared that. And this is something we talk about a lot in our Entrepreneurs Elite community, because it is very glamorized when someone raises this large sum of money and they're on the cover of all these magazines and online. This person raised $100 million, $10 million, $50 million. And it looks really glamorous. But as you said, there's a lot at stake when you go down the venture route. And most businesses, I would say, are not meant to be venture-backed and venture scalable, because you could build and run a very profitable bootstrap business, or you bring on a few angel investors, or you go for grants. And we have a lot of these resources in our community where we have people come speak about how to find alternative forms of non-dilutive capital as well. So I'm so glad that you shared that. Mm-hmm. Okay, Yushma. Tell me what has now happened over the past 2 years, because I know ultimately you do have a success story and ended up selling the business, but you're still running the company now. So talk to me about that process.
Yes. After our Series B financing, we pivoted to profitability. And that was very lucky for us that the food industry was a bit in turmoil. Blue Apron had gone IPO and it hadn't gone well. And because of that, the valuations in our industry completely tanked. So instead of raising extremely dilutive capital for further venture rounds, Series C and beyond, we decided to become profitable, weather the storm, and kind of fund ourselves. So that pivot is really hard, because that's not what venture businesses are meant to do. Going from burning millions a month to then, you know, making hundreds of thousands, or kind of trudging along in a more sustainable way. But it's great that we did that, because then when COVID hit, which was completely unexpected, our orders surged 400%. And we were very agile and like lean and mean and modular from an operations perspective and an execution perspective. So we were able to handle that surge without it breaking our processes or having so too much bureaucracy to be able to adapt and take that in. And then not only that, but financially we were lean. So all of that money and that revenue like fell right down to the bottom line, and we like raised a Series C just by existing that year. So that was kind of, you know, a lot of luck and some hard work that really paid off on the profitability journey. And then I guess the luck continued, because businesses started looking at Gobble for potential acquisition. And so we were looking at a few suitors in 2022, and that the M&A process is probably the hardest process I have ever gone through. It's multiple times more difficult, in my opinion, than raising a financing round or any kind of business turnaround. It's so high stakes. Someone is buying the entire entity, all the liabilities, you know, any skeletons in the closet, the future revenues. So not only is it high stakes from a liability and legal perspective, but the negotiations are next level too, because someone might fund you for $10 million or $20 million at some valuation, like $100 million or whatever it is. But when you're being purchased for like $100 million or $1 billion, like that's all being bought. And it's also, you know, your life work that you might be selling. And so there's just so much to manage and weather and strategize about in that process. I did something that I learned was a bit unconventional, and that was that I read every document that was part of that process. And I think the final, our M&A closing binder, our agreement was something like 120 to 150 pages, and the final binder was maybe like 250 pages of like legalese. And most people in their financings or incorporating, they rely on the lawyer to just do it, and you've never read the documents. And I learned that that's all great on sunny days, but on rainy days, if you didn't read your incorporating documents, you have no idea how your business works in bad situations. So that, me being so diligent about the process and detail-oriented and not just asking the lawyer to tell me what it says, really benefited us and gave our company more control with regards to how it happened, you know, taking care of our team and just avoiding even more unsavory surprises down the line.
Wow. I'm just trying to picture you reading those 500 pages. Yes. Learn every single thing of the bank.
Totally. And I was looking up like case law about things, because then, you know, then you're negotiating back and forth. So they're like, well, we want these rights. And I'm like, like, what's the precedent for that? And is that a normal ask or an abnormal ask?
Did you have advisors that you would go to ask some of these questions or talk to other founders who'd been through acquisitions before when some of these questions would come up?
Yes. There wasn't any one advisor or person. It's kind of like buoys in the ocean. And so you just like, I don't know why I'm using this analogy, but like you kind of like swim over to one buoy and like hold on and you're like, can you help me with this problem? And then go to the next one and they help you with a different problem. So it was kind of like a zone defense approach. And I had a number of different, mostly other CEOs and founders that had gone through it or just are just like great friends and thought partners and they understand who I am and what I want. And so they were able to, you know, give me the confidence and the strength I needed at various points. Sometimes you need advice that's more technical, and other times you just need, you know, someone to lean on.
How did you emotionally get through the whole experience with the acquisition? I know you said it was so much harder managing the acquisition process than the fundraising process and running the business. So how did you handle everything?
I don't know. Just like walked around San Francisco crying, basically. And that's not a joke. Really, I mean, I think just leaning on my friends and family. And at a certain point, I did try to take good care of myself, just like making sure I got up and took a 30-minute walk in between Zoom calls and like having like a green smoothie, simple things like that, because I forget everything it stands for, but there's that phrase that you shouldn't like halt. You shouldn't make decisions when you're like hungry, angry, something or tired. And that's how you feel in this process. And so it's always about like first principles and just like managing your own psychology, showing up fresh and having the strength to stand tall in the conversations. No matter what term we're talking about, the most important thing is like my clarity of mind and like the strength of my back. So I would focus on those fundamentals and really like take my time, write down my bullets, take a deep breath before I would like enter any negotiation.
Oh, super smart. I don't know if I told you, we have a big event, Entrepreneurs event coming up, our Founders Beacon events, and our whole theme is wealth and wellness for founders, because as we've all learned, if we're not taking care of our physical health and our mental health and our wellness, we can't take care of our businesses or anything. So that is our theme for this year. So you should come to it if you can.
Yeah, that sounds great. I'll mention one other thing about M&A processes, and that is that with almost every story I've heard from friends and even in our own story with Gobble, the deal gets pulled off the table. And typically after many, many months of negotiating and when you feel you're close to the finish line. For us, it was a few weeks before. For one of my friends, it was for two friends actually recently. And very unfortunately, it was the night before. And so it's a high stakes move, but companies can use that to try to rattle you or like cut the valuation in half or add some onerous terms at the last minute when you've been absolutely devastated. So the moment that I think about, and it happened a couple times, but in this process, was when that happened, when we had worked collaboratively for 6 months on this deal, hundreds of pages of documents. And because of one small thing, my counterpart, you know, just said, hey, let's just put our pencils down. Like, I can't believe this is what you want. And like the deal's off the table. And then there was kind of this like deafening silence for days. And it was people expect you to call. So it was very hard and took a lot of strength to not call and to just be okay with the deal being gone. Inevitably, they called us back and we got back on track and we didn't have to give up anything. But those moments can be really hard because it's this specific kind of deal is very all or nothing. And you're wrapped up in it for so long. And the line between success and failure is so thin that I'm just grateful we were able to cross that line. And the only way I know how is by, like, you know, having the strength, knowing your worth, knowing you really want something, but you don't need it. And kind of being like paranoid until the very last day and not counting chickens before they hatch.
What did it feel like the day the papers were finally signed?
Oh, man, that was very exciting. That was very exciting. I'm the kind of person that celebrates the small moments, like really takes time to just like takes the 5 minutes to mark the moment. So we signed the initial sale term sheet with one of the suitors that we ended up selling to. It was like on my sister's birthday. I had my best friends come over. We had a special pen, like opened a bottle of champagne. My whole family was on Zoom. we signed the term sheet. And even though that was just like a 15-minute activity, it was such a critical moment because that was the day we decided to be exclusive with just one partner. When the deal finally closed, kind of almost a year later, that day I was much more tired. But there, you know, that it was very satisfying. I felt a great relief and also, you know, just excitement in delivering something exciting for our shareholders and also for all of our employees. We had hundreds of employees total, including those who worked in our warehouse. And we made sure that every single person benefited from the acquisition.
That's so amazing. That must have just felt so good to be able to have them participate in that exit and great moment. Up next, Ushma highlights how personal development is key to breaking through career obstacles, and she reveals her biggest business secrets. Ushma, it's so incredible all you have accomplished over the years, the businesses that you have built. I have to ask you, what is your biggest business secret from all of your learnings over the years of growing multiple businesses?
I think I have a number of hopefully, you know, secrets that I've accumulated over the years, but I'll share kind of what I think is a funky one, and that is use your envy as a superpower. So anytime I would see anyone or anything and think, wow, like, how do they do that? I wish I was that, you know, whether it was someone who looked more put together or made the time to work out or, you know, hired this or that person. I realized that it was just like something that I wanted for myself and for some reason had a personal block, just hadn't achieved, maybe didn't think I could achieve. And it's, I think in the startup journey, we grow so much from failure. Failure actually leads to learnings, which leads to success. So I'm not afraid of it. And I think I've applied that same thought process to like personal growth. And when I see something that typically would make someone feel jealous or envious, I turn it into like, what is this telling me? What is missing in my life? Where do I need to grow and invest in? So thinking that way has just been so powerful because I think we all have these invisible mental ceilings that we will reach those ceilings in our growth and in our businesses. And we won't be able to hire as many people or grow so far because of our blind spots. So attacking those personally will help us professionally as well.
I love that. Last question for you, Ushma. What does being an entrepreneurista mean to you?
Oh, man. It means freedom. It means achieving the American dream. I think being a female entrepreneur or entrepreneurista is especially special. I think there are just fewer. And so it's more satisfying to write that story. And hopefully, just as people have lifted me up, to help lift up others to do the same.
Yes, absolutely. And that's what we're all here to do. And thank you so much for sharing your journey and story. And again, it's so incredible all you've accomplished. And I can't wait to continue to stay in touch, have you part of our community and see all the great things you're going to continue to do. Where can everyone find you and follow you on social? And for any of our members and listeners that want to try Gobble, who maybe haven't tried Gobble before, where should they head over to do so? And we will be linking out to everything in the show notes below.
Sure. I'm just at Ushma, which is O-O-S-H-M-A, on Twitter and Instagram. My email is ushma.garg@gmail.com. And you can try our delicious meal kits at gobble.com and let me know what you think.
Amazing. Thank you again for being here, Ushma. I'm Stephanie, and this is the best business meeting I've ever had.
Hey, thanks for listening and leaving us a 5-star review. We'd really appreciate it. And we'd love to stay in touch with each of you. You can listen to all of our latest episodes at entrepreneurista.com and connect with us on Instagram at entrepreneuristas. We'd also love to invite you to join the Entrepreneurista League, our private membership community for trailblazing women. You can head over to entrepreneurista.com/the-league. We'll see you there. Wishing you a productive week ahead.